You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
When you're a child, your parents' friends are often somewhat mysterious. And so it was for Barbara O'Hogan, whose mother used to take an elderly woman shopping in the Dunleary of her youth. In this evening's Lyric Feature, Barbara tells us the story of that woman, Winifred M. Letts. This is These Things I Wish.
I'm on Ballonclay Road in Killiney in South Dublin. Over there is Beech Cottage, where Winifred Letts lived. When I was young, my mother used to bring her to do her shopping every week in Connolly's supermarket on Patrick Street in Dunleary. And afterwards, Winifred would treat me to a glass of fresh orange juice and a Viennese finger. Then we'd come back here to Beech Cottage, and while my mother was unpacking the messages and putting them away, I would be in the hall looking at the books on her bookshelves and at her cooler press prints on the wall. I'm Barbara O'Hogan, and I have been championing the writings of Winifred Letts for years. I'm currently writing a book about her life and work. I have my own childhood memories of her, from when she lived in Killiney, County Dublin, in her final years. Oriana Connor, her great niece, knew her for much longer.
Well, I remember Aunt Wynne, as I will call her, as a very elderly lady. She probably wasn't at the time, but she seemed very elderly to me. And I see and remember her as a very kind presence. And she took my sister and myself off and gave us buns and tea at Bewley's.
Winifred Letts loved children, and she loved animals. And Oriana has one story about a trip to Dublin Zoo that perhaps also reveals something about her character.
This bear was in a cage, and he had very heavy, strong bars. And in front of the cage, there was another railing behind which people who were visiting the zoo could watch the bear, but under no circumstances could you go closer. But my aunt was very sorry for this bear, and she'd brought him a pot of honey, because she said he probably never has a chance to have honey, and bears like honey. So, being my dear aunt, she slipped under the barrier and she dipped her umbrella, the big pointy end of her umbrella, into this jar of honey and was smearing it on the bars, much to the delight of the bear, I may add, who was licking it off, when a distraught keeper came along and said, "Oh no, madam, oh no, you mustn't be in there."
I'm in the Phoenix Park, not far from Dublin Zoo, where Winifred Letts attempted to feed honey to the bear. And just outside the boundary of the park is the site of her mother's childhood home, Knockmaroon. Winifred was born in Manchester in 1882. She was the youngest of three girls. Her father, Ernest Letts, was a clergyman. Her mother was Mary Isabel Ferrier, and she grew up in Knockmaroon. Winifred loved coming to Ireland to her grandparents' home every summer, and she reminisced about this in later years.
I recall, as vividly as if it were yesterday, the annual journey to Ireland, the look of the train, the first breath of sea air on the Welsh coast, the tarry, painty smell of the boat, the sheer unimaginable rapture of seeing Kingstown Pier glide out, so it seemed, to meet us. Never was Phoenix Park so wonderful, with its twisted thorns and great expanses of grass, bright with the level evening sunlight, as on that day of arrival.
When she was 16, Winifred persuaded her parents to allow her to go to school in Ireland, and she enrolled at Alexandra College in 1898. A few years later, when her father died, the family moved to Ireland, and Winifred spent most of the rest of her life here. If she is remembered at all, it is probably as a poet. But Winifred Letts' first major achievement as a writer was as a playwright. Here's Dr. David Clare, lecturer in drama and theatre studies at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick.
She got interested after a trip to the Abbey Theatre. She said it was very unusual for her to choose to go to the Abbey because her family was a Gaiety family, so they would have preferred more popular fare, you know, touring English companies and that kind of thing. She thinks that the reason why she was attracted is because it was only sixpence to get in.
The play she saw was Synge's Riders to the Sea, and it had a profound effect on her.
This was not a play. It was life. It was the eternal battle of the man with the sea. The sea as they know it in the western coast. Not our polite sea that lets us bathe so safely at Black Rock Baths. This was tragedy as the Greeks knew it.
She was blown away, and she said that there was kind of stunned silence when they saw Synge's great tragedy, and she was really taken up with Synge's language.
Gradually, I came back to the normal day. There was Lady Gregory in the stalls wearing her black mantilla. With her was W.B. Yeats. I see him in a grey velvet coat. Or do I dream that? I went home still dazed, still entranced to the suburban placidity of Black Rock. But the spell of Synge's speech and tragedy lay upon me.
She felt so inspired that she just went ahead and wrote her own play.
I think there's only 3 or 4 months between her seeing Riders to the Sea and her own first play being staged.
This is Shirley-Ann Godfrey, a Government of Ireland Research Council scholar at the University of Galway, who is completing a PhD in drama and theatre.
She goes off and writes The Eyes of the Blind.
To my great surprise, the play was accepted.
And it's put on the 1st of April in 1907. And it's a very short play. A widow and her daughter, they're talking about a recent murder. And the daughter's sweetheart comes in, Lawrence O'Shaughnessy, fairly swiftly followed by another visitor who's a travelling man, a blind man, Phelim. And Phelim sees something that nobody else can see. He actually begins to speak with the ghost of the victim of this murder. He identifies Lawrence, the murderer.
The murderer then feels he must confess, and so he does. He admits to murder, and basically he's not going to marry his beloved now. He's going to jail.
Winifred Letts was definitely writing in the lineage of Lady Gregory and Synge, trying to capture the peasant speak.
My wedded wife you were to be, but a black sin has come between us now, my heart's core. And there'll be no peace for me till I've done what I may to atone, life for life. Maybe if I stayed, the curse would come on you too. Never would we be so close, but sorrow would come between us. Would you have it in your mind when your children were upon my knees, they were kissing a murderer? Never, sleeping or waking, working or talking, but the curse would be upon me.
Just 2 years later, in 1909, the Abbey Theatre staged another of her plays.
Her second play at the Abbey was The Challenge. And in this play, she's kind of moving into her own territory a bit more and maybe coming a bit closer to home in the sense that she's exploring the decayed Irish Anglican ascendancy. And so in this play, we actually have a man who has stayed put in his Georgian house in Dublin City on the north side of the river. And all the other homes have been turned into, all these great Georgian buildings have been turned into tenement slums. But he's hanging on with just his butler, Terence. He has this lovely relationship with the butler, but he's also harboring old wounds. And so when he has gotten word that a former neighbor of his who went to England and made very good is going to be in Dublin, he invites him over. But he has dark thoughts in mind because he's still angry about the fact that this man jilted his sister. He ends up challenging the man to a duel.
While not as successful, apparently, it does put Winifred Letts in a very select group of women playwrights. So she was the first woman after Lady Gregory to have more than one play staged at the Abbey Theatre. We don't see a main stage production then from Winifred Letts until 1941.
We'll hear about that production later. But Winifred Letts didn't just write drama. She wrote short stories, essays, novels, and her first collection of poetry was published in 1913. Here's Lucy Collins, Associate Professor of Modern Poetry in UCD.
Her first collection was Songs from Leinster and was divided into different parts, but the predominant element of it was about attachment to place. And it's also very almost insistent at times in its use of idiomatic language. So it's conjuring of a voice that is particularly Irish, but also specifically attached to place as well. And as the title suggests, the songs do suggest very much poems about ordinary people and emerging out of the day-to-day lives of ordinary people.
Many of the poems are set in the city.
These are really interesting poems, especially because we don't so often have female poets writing about city spaces at that time. And Letts has a really keen eye for the poverty in the city and for the social inequalities that are built into those urban structures.
The town. I wonder now, does God look down upon the town? And what he's thinking when he sees the people swarming there like bees. The alleys and the dirty lanes, the moiter of the trams and trains, the stately carriages galore. And then the poor, who traipse in the bitter sleet with broken boots upon their feet. I wonder what he thinks at night when angels set the stars alight and in the town the lamps are bright. Does he watch gaming rascals cheat, old drunken villains curse and fight, while girls, grown shameless, walk the streets? Always God hears the cherubim sing praise to him. But where he's sitting on his throne, can he hear starving women moan? Above the harping of each saint, are little children's voices faint? Can he, in all the music, hear them sob for fear? On dirty pavements babies sprawl, with them to mind them scarce less small. It's sure God hears the cries of these, and all the oaths and blasphemies of them that's never on their knees. He hears the drunkard's shout and bawl above the angels' melodies. I wonder what God thinks at all.
Other poems in the collection leave the city behind and look to the coastline of Wexford.
In a poem like The Harbour, for example, Letts uses what is a fairly common trope of identifying a very specific locality and place as the site for an almost nostalgic desire to, you know, wherever I am in the world, this is the place that I want to return to. But also within the structure and the tone of the poem, there's an interesting combination of a kind of warm description of place, but also in the shortened last line of each stanza, a strangely sort of melancholic tone, I think, comes in. And this is something that we see quite a lot in Letts's early work, is that combination of attachment and love for place, but also an acknowledgement of that, say, that melancholic, that sadness that might attend separation from place or being an outsider to a particular place.
The Harbour. I think if I lay dying in some land where Ireland is no more than just a name, my soul would travel back to find that strand from whence it came. I'd see the harbour in the evening light, the old men staring at some distant ship, the fishing boats they fasten left and right beside the slip, the sea wrack lying on the wind-swept shore, the grey thorn bushes growing in the sand, our Wexford coast from Arklow to Cahors, my native land. The little houses climbing up the hill, sea daisies growing in the sandy grass, the tethered goats that wait, large-eyed and still, to watch you pass. The women at the well with dripping pails, their men colloguing by the harbour wall, the coils of rope, the nets, the old brown sails, I'd know them all. And then the Angelus. I'd surely see the swaying bell against a golden sky. So God, who kept the love of home in me, would let me die.
Songs from Leinster was well received by critics, and there were lots of reviews of the book. It was published, of course, at a time when Irish work, and particularly work that identified its Irishness through its language and musicality, was very popular, and very popular for a London market as well as in Ireland. And it is very accomplished work, even though these are some of the earliest poems she wrote.
Her poetry collection attracted the attention of composers, and over the following years, many of them, including Charles Villiers Stanford, Ina Boyle, Ivor Gurney, Rhoda Coghill, Dorothy Park, and in more recent times, Ian Wilson, set Winifred Lett's poetry to music. I talked about this with her great niece, Oriana Connor. What do you think it made it so attractive to composers?
I think possibly the simplicity, that there was a theme she was putting in her poetry. And also, when you sing, you have to sing from the heart for it to get over at all. And Winifred's poems are all heart.
Interesting that you say about singing from the heart, because she has a lovely line at the end of a poem about the willow wren, and she says, "Sing in the quiet places of my heart," which I thought was a lovely piece.
Very nice. Were
there any particular songs of Winifred's that you liked to sing?
Well, of course, A Soft Day is well known, and indeed it is sometimes made a joke of with the drip, 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 which has to be very carefully pronounced when you're singing it. I remember my singing teacher, Mrs. Dillon, Margaret Dillon, who said, "It isn't drips, drips, drips."
A soft day, thank God, a wind from the south with a honeyed mouth, a scent of drenching leaves, bright beach and lime, white elder florets twine, and the soaking grass smells sweet, crushed by my toes.
She lived quite near us in 19 Fitzwilliam Square, and we lived in number 9. The house that they lived in, 19, was wonderfully Victorian, and there were little tables and there were little cabinets, and it was absolutely stuffed with things. And as a child, of course, I loved that. And my aunt was very good. She used to play Hunt the Thimble with me and my sister. And I found this terribly exciting as a child. So that's a game I remember very well.
I know you have lots of lovely things that Wynn gave you over the years, including the silver thimble that you used to go hunting for.
Yes, I do. I have the silver thimble. It's in my hand now. And a very good thimble it is too. It fits very nicely on the middle finger, which is what I use to sew with. She also gave me over the years, particularly as a child, little things that children love. One is a little tiny glass with a little edelweiss printed on it, and it's a very deep blue. And when I look at this, I always think of Aunt Wynn, because that was her favourite colour. She also was extremely kind and gave me a beautiful necklace with glass beads. And there are other things that she has given me over the years, and yes, they make me think of her.
Winifred related so well to children and wrote many children's stories and radio plays and novels. And she gave Oriana, and later me, copies of some of her books for children. Do you remember reading her books?
I think Naughty Sophia was the one that really got me. I really appreciated that one. And that was done on BBC, I think on the children's programme. It was serialised.
That was her favourite book as well. I mean, she writes about that. That was the one she liked most herself.
On Monday, she stuck out her tongue at His Excellency, the Lord of the Privy Purse. And he saw. On Tuesday, she peeled a long strip of wallpaper off a wall in the third grandest drawing room. On Wednesday, she stoutly refused to say her catechism to His Grace the Archbishop. On Thursday, she threw painty water out of her nursery window, though she knew that General von Hegel and Baron von Schlie were talking underneath. On Friday, this was a terrible day, she threw a peeled banana at Baron von Schlie, and it hit him on the nose. And this was because he had ordered her white mice to be put under arrest as a punishment for the painty water incident.
He'd best be aware when the tour was made. Come in, utter that, come in, utter that, come in, you bold, unbeatable child. He's after upsetting the widow Foy's pail. She'll murder him yet, widow Foy. And he's pulling the massacre down with a tail in the hoggy that young one is born for the jail. Come in, utter that, come in, utter that, come in, you rogue of a villainous boy. Go tell him his mother is seeking a stick for a boy that is terrible wild. If he cares for his failings, he'd better be quick. He'll draw in his horns when he sees me will make. Come in, utter that, come in, utter that, come in, come in, you bold, unbeatable child.
In 1914, the First World War broke out. Winifred and her sister Mary joined a Red Cross voluntary aid detachment.
They were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen.
Winifred was posted to the 2nd Western General Hospital in Manchester as a VAD nurse. She continued to write poetry, but the tone and subject matter changed dramatically from her earlier work.
Earth Voices Whispering is an anthology of Irish war poetry from 1914 to 1945. It was published in 2008. And one of the things I was very keen to do was to involve women's voices in the anthology. And one of those women's voices is Winifred Letts.
Gerald Daw is a poet and emeritus professor of English from Trinity College Dublin.
Out of her experience looking after men who had suffered, soldiers who had suffered, she wrote some extraordinary poems. One of the poems that really intrigued me is a poem called Screens in a Hospital. What makes it such a, in a way, chilling poem is that it reveals clearly that the boy is dying and there is no way that he's going to recover. And that these screens are almost screening him from the world, from the rest of the hospital. and that when he goes, the screens will be put back in place, the bed will be cleaned, and another young boy, young man, will be put in his place.
Screens. They put the screens around his bed. A crumpled heap I saw him lie. White counterpane and rough dark head. Those screens, they showed that he would die. They put the screens about his bed. We might not play the gramophone. And so we played at cards instead. And left him dying there, alone. The covers on the screen are red. The counterpanes are white and clean. He might have lived and loved and wed. But now he's done for at 19. An ounce or more of Turkish lead. He got his wounds at Suvla Bay. They've brought the Union Jack to spread upon him when he goes away. He'll want those three red screens no more. Another man will get his bed. We'll make the row we did before. But, Jove, I'm sorry that he's dead.
The two lines that never fail to shake me, and they shook me when I read them, is he might have lived and loved and wed, but now he's done for at 19. Now, you could imagine Siegfried Sassoon coming out with that, but here Letts is ahead of the game, so to speak. She's identifying sacrifice and loss at such a young age.
The poem Screens is from Winifred Letts' 1916 collection, Halloween and Poems of the War.
This collection of poems very much speaks of Letts' direct experience in the war. She's preserving her memories, I think, through poetry.
Idelle Hanley is an independent academic researcher who has completed a PhD on women's war poetry and autobiographical writing.
They look at war's impact on women. They're not solely or specifically looking at the impact of war on combatants or soldiers. She references women, she references women's turmoil, their suffering.
One of the most haunting poems in the collection is The Deserter.
I think desertion and the whole notion of desertion was contemptible in the eyes of the British military regime. The notion of coward, of not fighting for your country, was one side of that story. But the other side was, we didn't make men into deserters. This did not happen, when in fact it did. It did take a generation, generations, before it would be, seen for what it was. Breakdown, mental and physical breakdown.
What I like the most, I think, about this poem is the way it begins. There's a real sense of a story here. There was a man, don't mind his name. There's a sense of a story, but there's also a sense of anonymity. In a sense, she's protecting the man and his identity. She's not shaming him, judging him. It's the sense of betrayal that she focuses on.
Towards the end of the poem, she brings in the figure of the mother.
So she brings women, albeit as far away as the domestic front, into the arena of war, into the domain of war, to suggest that war affects all genders, all generations.
The deserter. There was a man, don't mind his name, whom fear had dogged by night and day. He could not face the German guns, and so he turned and ran away. Just that. He turned and ran away. But who can judge him? You or I? God makes a man of flesh and blood who yearns to live and not to die. And this man, when he feared to die, was scared as any frightened child. His knees were shaking under him. His breath came fast. His eyes were wild. I've seen a hare with eyes as wild, with throbbing heart and sobbing breath. But oh, it shames one's soul to see a man in abject fear of death. But fear had gripped him. So had death. His number had gone up that day. They might not heed his frightened eyes. They shot him when the dawn was grey. Blindfolded when the dawn was grey. He stood there in a place apart. The shots rang out, and down he fell. An English bullet in his heart. An English bullet in his heart. But here's the irony of life. His mother thinks he fought and fell a hero, foremost in the strife. So she goes proudly to the strife, her best, her hero's son she gave. Oh, well for her, she does not know he lies in a deserter's grave.
I've always wondered if Winifred lost someone who was special to her in the war. Some of the poems in the collection seem to me to be very personal, like these lines from her poem Dead, where she says, "And I remembered how one day in spring you found a wren's nest in the wall and said, 'Hush, listen, I can hear them quarrelling. The tennis court is marked, the wrens are fled, but you are dead, beloved, you are dead.'" And I know that she wrote to her friend, the writer Monk Gibbon, describing the intense sadness that she felt for many years, waking every morning, having vaguely hoped that she would die during the night. And she described having known and lost happiness. But Winifred did find happiness in later years, when she married William Henry Foster Verscoyle in 1926, when she was 44. He was a widower who had lost two sons in the war and was 23 years older than her. He died long before I knew Winifred, but Oriana has memories of him.
I do remember, I was very young at the time, but Uncle Will was in a wheelchair and he had a plaid rug over his knee and was almost a typical Victorian gentleman in a wheelchair. And I can remember his smile and I can remember his face very well. I don't remember his voice, or I can't remember ever saying anything to him.
Winifred and William shared a love of nature, of exploring archaeological sites, of travel, and spending time at William's farm in County Kildare. That's where my mother got to know her, when she was a child and her father was working as William Verscoyle's steward on the farm.
She absolutely adored him. He fulfilled for her that other side that all women and men want, is a partner, a loving partner.
And she wrote beautiful poems to him, like Wishes for William, and one then about You Who Loved Trees, which was printed in Country Life after his death.
And I noticed that in her diaries on their honeymoon and this extraordinary trip around Ireland they took, there was enormous love and affection there.
Wishes for William. These things I wish you for our friendship's sake. A sunburnt thatch, a door to face the sun at Westering, the noise of homing rooks, a kind old lazy chair, a courtly cat to rub against your knees, shelves of well-chosen books. I wish you these. I wish you friends whose wisdom makes them kind, well-leisured friends to share your evening's peace, friends who can season knowledge with a laugh. A hedge of lavender, a patch of thyme, with sage and marjoram and rosemary, a damask rosebush and a hive of bees and cabbages that hold the morning dew, a blackbird in the orchard boughs, all these and God bless you. Children, no matter whose, to watch for you with flowered faces at your garden gate, and one to watch the clock with eager eyes saying, he's late, he's late.
When she married Will, she inherited his family, naturally, with whom she got on very well. Do you think she missed having her own children?
Very hard to say, isn't it? but of course it must have been a sorrow to her. But she certainly made up for it for the contact she had with children. And she also used to take children out from what would it have been, an orphanage, wouldn't it?
Is that the Bird's Nest home in Dunleary?
Yes.
Do you remember she used to call them her Saturday nephews?
Yes, her Saturday nephews. You're quite right.
Poor little Peter Morrissey, what way is he at all? His mother's supping porter till she's like to get a fall. And all the work his father does is propping up a wall. He's ne'er a shirt upon his back, nor gansey to his name. There never was a pair of boots the likes of him could claim. And his after trenance on glass, the way he's walking lame. When decent children lie in bed, you'll see him out at night. When he's screeching mail and herald, or joining in a fight to hold his own. He not half their height. You'll see him in the winter times travailing through the wet. He's not so wishful to go home. Well, likely he'll be bet. If he's killed with cold and damp, who is there that will fret? Laughing in the sun, and he's always ready after school to sing and leap and run. His mother likes the drink too well to spare the child a toy. You'd think maybe the
alongside her poetry and essays and children's stories and novels, she continued to write plays that were broadcast on radio in Ireland and Britain. Then in 1941, she had her biggest success with drama when her play Hamilton and Jones was staged at the Gate Theatre in Dublin.
Hamilton and Jones is a powerful three-act play that has great comedy in it and yet also manages a great social observation, great sense of the scope of Irish history through the period that she's examining. Act 1 is set in 1886, Act 2 in 1916, and Act 3 in 1936.
And it follows the fortunes of this merchant family in Dublin, quite likely modelled on her own maternal family. I think they describe themselves as silk importers and haberdashers. And it's concerned with, well, primogeniture. They need a son, obviously, to take over. And there's pressure on each generation to marry into the Jones.
By the time we get to 1916, one member of the family is fighting at the front in the British Army, and the other is taking part in the Easter Rising and is actually on the run and actually hides under a sofa during that act and has to be helped to escape. By the time we get to 1936, we're very much into post-independence Ireland. But what is suggested throughout the play is that the future belongs to strong women.
Letts herself was a suffragist and she objected to the duty in the home clause. So the third act, we have a young, educated woman who says she wants to work in the family business and she would be the first daughter to do that. And she also, you know, won't subject herself to a quasi-arranged marriage. She will marry who she loves.
You've got to listen to me, great-gran. I tell you that you've met your match in me because I'm like you. I'm you over again. I want my way, as you do. I love power, and so do you. I'm the last Hamilton of our lot, and I'm going into the business myself. I shall learn it from A to Z, and it shall never go down while I'm in it. And when I marry, for I shall marry, it'll be to a man as keen as I am.
She focused in her play, Hamilton and Jones, on a section of Irish society that was perhaps being neglected in other quarters.
And there's an implicit criticism of Yeats's focus on, as he put it in one of his poems, the noble and the beggarman, because in the play they kind of talk about the fact that in the Irish popular imagination there's only the gentry and then the peasantry, quote-unquote, or the lower classes, and that people don't really have much of a sense of the Irish middle class, and yet there they are.
Winifred Letts was conscious of class, and as someone from a Church of England background, she has sometimes been referred to as an Anglo-Irish writer.
Anglo-Irish is dangerous territory because we associate it with the big house, and here she is herself insisting on her middle-class credentials.
She has also been called an English writer, a British writer, an Irish writer.
In many ways, she insisted on her Irishness. But at the same time, the Englishness is there, and I think it manifests itself mainly in a strong sense of Britishness. One could say she's kind of Irish and British more than English, per se.
We can see her as actively choosing her Irish identity as an artist. And this is, in some ways, what makes her such an interesting figure for us now, because she has insight, affiliation, understanding of both sides, of both an English identity and an Irish identity.
I would describe Winifred Letts as an Irish writer, chiefly because I suspect she might self-identify as an Irish writer.
But we have a member of the family, Oriana Connor, to ask whether Winifred Letts considered herself Irish or English.
Aunt Wynne and my grandmother, great-grandmother, would have very much considered themselves Irish.
Now, this will bring you back. It's the theme tune from Ciarán MacMahon's long-running Sunday morning programme on RTE Radio. Over 20 years after Winifred Letts had died in 1972, my mother, Frances O'Hogan, was a guest on the programme. And she told an anecdote about when Winifred had married, becoming Mrs. Verscoyle.
She was a member of the Arts Club, which I think was in Fitzwilliam Street.
It still is.
Yes. And I think her husband wasn't too keen on that because they met on a Sunday morning and he didn't think that was quite in keeping. Yes.
Frances, she said something very, very interesting, funny to you one time, which has to do with the Arts Club.
Yes, she told me her husband once said to her, shortly after they were married, that there were two things Miss Letts did that Mrs. Verscoyle shouldn't do. One was to swim at Sea Point Tower and the other was to be a member of the Arts Club.
She blithely ignored those suggestions and continued to swim at Sea Point Tower and to attend the Arts Club with enthusiasm. Ciarán MacMahon dedicated that whole episode in November 1996 to stories of the life of Winifred Letts and readings of her work. But really, in the decades after that, I rarely heard her name mentioned or her work quoted. But perhaps we are now seeing the beginning of a revival of interest. In February 2023, a Cola Press print of her poem St. Bridget was chosen to hang in an Taoiseach's office in government buildings, marking the role of the Green Party in the coalition and our new bank holiday. and I was thrilled to see her poem Dead included in Windfall, a new anthology of Irish nature poems, edited by Jane Clark.
People are now seeing the breadth of her writing. She could write about fairies and animals and little things like that, but there was also that woman who wrote about war, who wrote about death and wrote about grief, and was, to this very day, so modern, because people's emotions don't change. People's love doesn't change. Distress and loss are still a real thing. And she could write that to one's very heart.
I've come now to the Church of Ireland graveyard in Rathcoole in County Dublin. In front of me is a grave marked by a tall monument in the shape of a broken column. Winifred's husband, William, is buried here with his parents. Winifred once wrote in her diary about where she would like to be buried. "It may be untidy, but I'd rather have nature make and keep my bed than the dreary proprieties of a cemetery. Oh, fear. But that isn't quite what happened. Winifred is buried here in Rathcoole with William." This side reads, "Winifred M. Letts, 10th of February 1882 to 7th of June 1972. Loving wife of William H. Foster Verscoyle." These words were only added in June 2022, 50 years after Winifred's death. And Oriana and I were so pleased that President Michael D. Higgins was here with us on that occasion. But I'll be even more pleased when Winifred Mabel Letts is remembered as a poet, a novelist, a children's writer, an essayist, and a playwright. And when more people get to read her work, I think that's what she would want too.
musical setting by Ian Wilson of Winifred Lett's poem The Harbour, performed by the Enniscorthy Choral Society, Gorey Choral Group, Wexford Festival Singers, Whisht, and the Irish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Fergus Shiel, bringing to a close that programme, These Things I Wish. Also in the programme, we heard Stanford's settings of Winifred Lett's poem A Soft Day, performed by James Griffith and Clifford Benson, and The Bold Unbiddable Child and Little Peter Morrissey, performed by Finian Collins and Sharon Carty. These Things I Wish was presented by Barbara O'Hogan, who is writing a biography of Winifred Lett's to be published by the South Dublin Libraries later this year. The contributors were David Clare, Shirley Ann Godfrey, Lucy Collins, Gerald Daw and Idel Hanley. The readers were the actors Ingrid Craigie and Andrew Bennett. And our particular thanks goes to Oriana Connor for permission to quote from the writings of Winifred Lett's and for sharing her memories of her great aunt. The producer was Claire Cunningham and sound supervision was by Tin Pot Production. The programme was a Rockfinch production for RTE Lyric FM. And that programme is dedicated to the memory of the poet and academic Gerald Daw, who died last week and who would be known to regular listeners of this programme as a frequent contributor who generously shared his learning, his poetry and his insights with us over the years. And may he rest in peace.
This week's Lyric feature was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. The producer for Lyric FM was Owen O'Kelly.